Hi, this is Madhur Jaffrey, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. You're the bomb.
Hi, Bomb Squad. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, where we talk to the most interesting women in and around the world of food. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. We have a great show for you today. I know I say that every week, but it's really true this week. I'm here with our producer, Jess Seidman, at the Beatrice Inn in New York's West Village, and we're about to interview the restaurant's absolute force of a chef, Angie Marr. Angie took the Beatrice Inn from ho-hum to white-hot through talent and a hell of a lot of hustle. She just released her very first cookbook, Butcher and Beast, and it doesn't look like any cookbook out there. It is, like everything she does, very Angie. Chic, cool, creative, and very carnivorous. Thank you to the sponsors of today's podcast, Le Cordon Bleu, the world's most prestigious group of culinary schools, and Emmy, the makers of beautiful cheese from Switzerland, like my favorite, Gruyere. We have some housekeeping. Radio Cherry Bomb is headed to Kansas City, Missouri on Monday, November 4th for our Food for Thought tour. We'll be hanging out with the Missouri Bomb Squad at Corvino. You can snag a ticket at cherrybomb.com. And thank you very much to Kerry Gold for supporting our tour. Jubilee Seattle tickets are sold out. Thank you to everyone who bought a ticket. We're also doing another fun event in Seattle on Sunday, November 3rd. We're hosting a guest chef dinner at the London Plain. Chef Zara Duncanson will be cooking with Cherry Bomb's culinary director, Kia Damone. You can visit the London Plain website or check out our Instagram for tickets and more information. We'll be right back with Angie Marr of the Beatrice Inn after this message. Hey, Bomb Squad, let's talk about Emmy cheese from Switzerland. Emmy's beautiful variety of cheeses are crafted from the freshest milk from local Swiss farms. One of our favorites is Emmy Le Gruyere AOP. With notes of candied walnuts, spice, and dried fruit, Emmy's Le Gruyere AOP is perfect for snacking. And if you want to get more creative, you can do what Chef Elizabeth Faulkner does and make an apple and Le Gruyere crumble. This perfect fall recipe is fragrant with nutmeg and cinnamon, and the apple and Gruyere are perfect companions. Make it next level by melting some Emmy raclette on top. Looking for something more savory? How about this special recipe from Chef Elizabeth? French onion soup pizza with Emmy Gruyere AOP, fresh thyme, and mushrooms. You can find these recipes and more at emmyusa.com, and you can find Emmy's delicious cheeses from Switzerland, the ones with the distinctive blue and red logo, at your favorite grocery store or cheesemonger. Enjoy my conversation with Angie Marr. Angie Marr.
Hi.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very well.
I can't believe you're sitting. You're not standing. But I was going to say, I can't believe you're still standing. You have had quite the month already.
Yes, it's been a little bit crazy, but in a good way.
How are you feeling?
Good. Really, really good. It's exciting. It's overwhelming. And I think it's like just starting to sink in.
Are you open tonight?
Mm-hmm.
You're open 7 days a week, right?
No, yeah. 6 days.
6 days. What's your day of rest?
Supposedly Sunday, okay. But we've had private events on Sunday for the past 3 weeks. So,
well, you look like a rock star.
Thank you.
Seriously, I don't know how
it's all the concealer.
It's not all the concealer. You look amazing. I'm impressed that this is how you roll into work at 11 in the morning. So,
thank you.
Bravo, you. All right. So you got into the chef game kind of late. You worked in real estate in your 20s, right?
Yeah, I did.
How did you wind up in real estate?
Well, I, like any, you know, good daughter that was being told to go to medical school or become a lawyer or own a business, you know, none of that stuff was for me. So I decided that I was going to be in corporate real estate and sell, you know, very big office buildings. And so that's what I did.
And you wound up in Los Angeles, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in LA for 12 years.
So for 12 years.
Yeah.
So when did you decide I really, really want to be a chef?
Well, I kind of got sick of corporate life. I couldn't do it anymore. And I really wanted to do something creative. So I left my job. I traveled all over Europe and East Africa and I was just kind of really trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I was just like, I have a lot of money saved up. I'm just going to go travel. I'm going to like do the thing and live my best life. And I did. And when I was in Spain, that's when I realized I was like, I should really be cooking. I should just be cooking. So yeah, I basically like ran out of money, came back to the States and, you know, put my last, you know, $50,000-$60,000 in a culinary school and moved to New York.
Where did you go to culinary school?
The French Culinary Institute.
Okay. So you come from a restaurant family.
Mm-hmm. I do.
So is this just you fulfilling your destiny?
I think I should have been doing this all along. You know, I think that, you know, being in corporate world is probably just like a pit stop for me. but I'm glad that I did it. You know, I'm glad that I did it because there's, you know, so much about this. It's not just, there's, you know, the creative aspect, which is amazing. And that's why, you know, we all do it. But the reality is that this is a business. So, you know, I think had I not had that experience, I wouldn't have been able to run the business.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you worked for other people when you were in real estate, right?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did.
So tell us about your family. You have a famous aunt who mm-hmm. really mm-hmm. was a trailblazer in Seattle.
Yeah.
Tell us about her.
Well, my aunt was Ruby Chow, and she was a restaurateur and politician in Seattle. She opened up her restaurant, which was called Ruby Chow's, in 1948.
Best name.
Yeah, best name. Best name. Yeah, so she opened that up in 1948, and it was, you know, coming out of the war. You know, if you were Chinese in America, you legally could not own a business unless it was a restaurant or a laundromat, because there was actually a law called the Chinese Exclusionary Act. And so, you know, that's how my family got into the business. They didn't do it out of passion. They did it out of, you know, necessity. They had to make a living. But I think over the years, it became a passion, you know, because it wasn't just my aunt, you know, that had the restaurant, but like a lot of my other family members had restaurants. One of my other aunts had a frozen food business. So, you know, that was really how I grew up, was like running around, you know, my cousins or my uncles or aunties' restaurants and, you know, running around a frozen food factory. So
was your Aunt Ruby alive?
She was,
when you were,
yeah.
When you were younger?
Yeah, she was. She had a really big part in raising me.
Mm-hmm.
I lived a block away from her.
What was she like?
She was a force. She was so incredible. She was a force. You know, I think my dad was one of 10 kids. You know, he's got sisters and, you know, they were all just really, really strong women. And it's like in our family, it's like, it's just the women run everything.
Do you remember her restaurant?
No, it was closed by the time
okay.
I was born. But, you know, she just had this like incredible sense of hospitality. It was just so insane. And I mean, I grew up going over to her house every week, you know, and having Sunday supper over there. She would be over at my dad's house and we'd have Sunday supper over there. So she was a very incredible woman.
Does anything remain?
Recipes,
photos,
yeah,
journals?
Absolutely. Photos. I mean, you know, just the families. Like I have so much stuff in storage from that. You know, Bruce Lee was a dishwasher in her kitchen. And, you know, she was actually very good friends with Warren Magnuson, who was responsible for repealing the Chinese Exclusionary Act. So, you know, a lot of that remains.
Yeah.
And, you know, coincidence, it's really funny because when I was a kid, my dad used to say, you're just like your Aunt Ruby. You're just like her. You're so stubborn. It was when I was like 5. Coincidentally, she and I have the exact same birthday, which is June 6th.
What's your sign?
I'm a Gemini.
Okay.
Yeah. It's shocking, right? But yeah, so, you know, we had the exact same birthday. And it's just interesting now because when I think about the parallels between Ruby Chow's and the Beatrice Inn and the life that she had and, you know, the one that I'm building, it's very, very similar. And I guess, you know, my dad must have been right all the time.
Do you think you'll ever do a project connected to what she started?
It's all in the works, Carrie.
Okay. I can't wait.
It's all in the works.
I'm dying to see. You and I have talked about her for a few years now.
Yeah.
So one of these days I have to see. So I would love to see some photos and,
I absolutely,
and a menu
when we're in
and all of that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
When we're in Seattle together.
Great. That would be
sure.
fun. That would be fun. All right. So you're at culinary school.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear you've got the skills.
I mean, I hope so.
What was your first gig out of culinary school?
I worked for Andrew Tarlow. I was at Diner and Marlowe and Sons, and then I went off to go open Reynard with him. And then after that, I went to the Spotted Pig and worked for April, and then came here.
What were you learning about yourself as a chef?
You know, I learned that I think, you know, I've always taken myself very seriously from the get-go. you know, I, like, as you know, like, I'm very low key. I'm very, like, just, you know, working all the time.
And I don't know if I would use the term low key, but yes, you work all the time.
I work all the time. Really? You don't think I'm low key?
I don't think you're low key. Makes me want to look up the definition of low key.
I mean, okay, well, but, you know, I just, like, I work all the time. And, you know, I think that's kind of, like, always been my thing, you know, is that I've always just taken myself really seriously and just, like, been there to work or to learn. And that's really it. So, and I'm still that way. I just haven't changed.
So Andrew's organization is very different from the Spotted Pig organization. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to say anything about your time at the Spotted Pig.
Yeah, well, you know, it was really interesting because what I learned from Andrew was, you know, I really learned how to cook there, right? The menu would change every single day. Mm-hmm. And
Andrew gets a lot of credit for establishing what came to be known as sort of like Brooklyn cuisine. Mm-hmm. You know, he was an early player when Brooklyn was emerging as a force.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In the restaurant world.
Yeah, and you know, it was really interesting because, you know, at his restaurants, the menu changes every single day and there's no prep cooks. And, you know, I would go in and I would be like, you know, there were carrots on the menu. I was like taking them out of a trash bag and scrubbing mud off of them because they had just been pulled out of the ground like, you know, 3 hours before. And, you know, and that's really it. It taught me how to work fast. It taught me how to work really hard. It taught me how to work very clean. But Andrew himself, I think, is just a phenomenal guy. And what I really learned from him is the sense of hospitality, not just with guests, but with his employees. Like, he would come into Reynard or Diner, wherever he was, and he would go around the room and he would shake hands with every single employee every single day. He would say hello, and then he would do the same thing before he left, and he would say goodbye and thank everybody for being there. And that always really stuck with me because I just think that it's how we should run business, right? He never Irish exited. He never did any of that. He really took a personal interest in everybody. And that really left an impression on me, you know? And even now when I see him, you know, one of the nicest things that he ever says to me is when I see him at events, he says, you know, I'm so proud of you because you've done me proud. And he's like, all of your success is my success too, and I'm so proud of you. And it's so lovely that he even remembers me because he's got multiple different restaurants and, you know, has done all of these different things, but he still remembers me there. And that really leaves an impression. So it's fantastic. But yeah, so then, you know, I wanted to come back to the city and cook, and I went to the Spotted Pig. It gave me, like, April gave me a dedication to perfection in food. And I never realized that that level of perfection existed before. And for me, that's something that I will always thank her for because it carried over to the way I run my kitchen today, like the perfection in each dish and, you know, whether parsley is like, you know, a quarter of an inch too big or, you know, whatever. I really found an appreciation for getting the best ingredients possible. And that is something that I didn't know before. Mm-hmm. And you know, I wasn't with her that long. I was there for maybe a year before I came over to the Beatrice. But it, you know, it definitely had an impression on me.
Were you surprised by the allegations against Ken regarding all the harassment?
No, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I would be shocked if he was surprised.
Did that also inform how you run the Beatrice?
Yeah, I mean,
because you learn from the good and the bad.
Yeah, you learn from the good and the bad. And, you know, I think that the culture at the Pig is what it was then is something that I never really partook in because, as I mentioned earlier, like, I'm all like, you know, I was never there to be anybody's friend. I was never there to, like, you know, kick it and, like, have a drink at, you know, the end of the night. Like, I was literally there to work and to learn as much as I could because that's all I've ever been, you know, but that's always how I run my restaurant now. It's like, you know, we have a completely dry house. There's no shift drinks. It's like, we are here to work and to learn.
Shift drink, for those of you who don't know what that means, it's a long tradition that at the end of the shift, mm-hmm. everybody gets a free drink on the house. And
I don't do that.
And, you know, post Me Too, a lot of people realize that it was a tradition that needed to end.
But we were doing it before Me Too. I've been doing that since 2013 when I got here.
Mm-hmm.
I took over the restaurant from Graydon, and it was like, no, it's a dry house. And I, you know, but that's just always how I've been. I mean, Carrie, how many times do you really ever see me out and about socializing? Not that often.
True.
Yeah.
True.
And when I am, I'm having water. So, you know, that's just kind of how I am. So, yeah. So it's, you know, for me, when I took over my own kitchen, it was definitely something that I wanted, was to have everybody just very focused. And it's less about, it's more about the team building, mm-hmm. you know, and the team building based off of bettering each other as cooks and as restaurant professionals versus the team building that centers around having a beer at the end of the night. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when you were at the Pig, it was a very happening place.
Mm-hmm.
The Beatrice Inn was not a very happening place.
No, it was not.
How did they get you over here?
Well, it took like 2 months and a lot of convincing. They called me and I didn't want the job. It had just gotten this like terrible review in the Times, and I was like, that's career suicide. I don't want to do it.
And it had a very high profile owner at the mm-hmm. time, Graydon Carter, who was the editor in chief of Vanity Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Was Graydon the one calling you?
No, it was his partners. And I just, you know, I just didn't want to do it. I didn't fully understand what it would be, what it would mean for me to take over this space. Pat LaFreda is a very dear friend of mine, and he's the one who told me. He was like, you have to take the job. He goes, nobody is paying attention right now. Just got a terrible review. It's never going to get reviewed again. Go learn on somebody else's dime. And that's what I did.
That's interesting advice.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the man's never steered me wrong, so...
Yeah, he's a big mentor of yours, which we will get to. So you take over the B,
mm-hmm.
as you like to call it.
Yeah.
And what did you find when you got here?
Oh my God. I mean, it was insane. It was a lot of guests that were like, you know, I want this, 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 and this, and none of those things were on the menu. You know what I mean?
So it was a fancy diner.
Yeah, it was just like one of those things. And
were they spoiled friends of the owners?
I think it was more the crowd that it attracted. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't necessarily know if they were like, they knew each other, but I think it was just more the crowd that it attracted. You know, I like, as we talk about now, like how I never kowtow to anybody. It's like, I was like, definitely like that then. I think it's gotten worse now because my name is on the lease. So I feel that I can do that more so. But you know, in 2013, it was like, it was a battle. Not just with guests, but also with, you know, internally with like employees, because it wasn't the place that was known for great customer service, was known for like a lot of, you know, time and care and effort, right, put into taking care of our guests and each other. So it was like a battle for me to really get it to where, you know, to start to turn it around.
So how do you even do that? So you've got to keep it open. You mm-hmm. can't close it. You've got to keep bringing money in, but at the same time, you've got to change everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I obviously, like, I didn't own it then, right? Mm-hmm. But I at the very least, I had control of the kitchen.
You had your pride.
Yeah, exactly. I had my integrity, I had my pride, my dignity. You know, and look, the first thing I did, you know, it was my first week here, and the first thing I did was I got in, kind of looked at how everybody was working, and there was no real integrity in the food and the cooking. It was just kind of like the cooks in the kitchen and had this culture of like, let's just send it out and we'll fix it on the next one. And like, I would die if I ever did that. I would die. And you know, I mean, the first thing I did, I think it was my second day, I walked in and there was a pastry chef who, you know, was just here during the day, wasn't even working service. And I was like, you make how much an hour? I was like, you make how much? I was like, gotta go. I'll do my own desserts, you know? Because it really, you know, it's just, again, it comes back to how you run a business, because it's about money
mm-hmm.
and it's about how we manage it, right? And it's about working efficiently and having the right people. And like, I personally would rather have less people on my team, but the right people on my team. And I'd rather have us all roll up our sleeves and do everything the way that things should be done versus having bodies to just fill slots and shifts, because that never does anybody any good, you know? And you don't have that, you know, when you're just filling bodies into a schedule, it's just more about, okay, let's just fill bodies. Who cares if they do a good job? I just need to cover it, right? And there's times that like people will come in the restaurant and, you know, I won't have a porter. Somebody calls out, like, I'll be washing dishes myself. But that's just what we do, you know? That's what we do, and it's what we have to do. And It was a very slow process to turn it around.
It was slow.
It, when,
and I mean, when I look back, it looks like you did it so quickly, but...
When I bought it,
probably didn't feel like that.
No. I mean, it mm-hmm. wasn't until I bought it in 2016 where it was like, okay, I get to do everything my way.
But you got a great review before you bought it.
I didn't.
Wait, when did the did the Pete review come after you bought it?
Yeah, right after I bought it.
So you really did get to kind of operate under the radar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I bought it in April of 2016.
All right. So let's talk about that.
We didn't say anything. That was the thing. We kept it a secret.
Got it.
Yeah, because I knew that as soon as people found out that we bought it from Graydon.
Because that's a big news story.
Yeah, that we would just get reviewed immediately, and I wasn't ready for that. So, you know, I bought it in April. My partner, who's my cousin, she and I said nothing to anybody, not even our closest friends. And I used that entire summer to recipe test and streamline and, like, really, you know, like, pick out plateware and, like, do all the things that I needed to do.
How much did it change from before you owned it to when you finally owned it?
A lot, you know, a lot. I mean, it definitely changed a lot. It was, you know, it was always a battle because this place was never known for its food. And mm-hmm. I, you know, I'm all about
right. It was
food,
like a
so.
Club before
much,
it became
yeah,
a restaurant. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. So,
I mean, it has a long New York history.
It's a long New York
but
history.
But before Graydon took it over, it had been a club
exactly.
famous for like.
Well, you know, I still get people walking in the door that are like, oh, this is Graydon Carter's restaurant. I'm like, have you been living under a rock for the last 3 years? Like, where have you been? It definitely. So we bought it in April of 2016, said nothing, kept the exact same menu that whole summer, even though it killed me. I kept the exact same menu, ran a couple of the new things as specials just to like get it all mm-hmm. down, you know. I think it went public in July of 2016, like end of July in 2016. And I shut the doors immediately, like that week, because I was like, no, like it's not going to happen. So I shut the doors. All of August we were closed. And that's when we really like
wow.
finalized the menu and did all
the
things.
How did you get the money to purchase the restaurant?
I'm very fortunate that I went into business with my cousin and we just really scraped together everything we had to buy it. You know, and look, by the time we opened this restaurant, like, we had no money. We had like zero money. You know, I was in London cooking that August for a week and we didn't have the plateware that we wanted. And like one of the big things at the Beatrice that everybody loves is all this like, you know, beautiful silver and pewter plateware mm-hmm. and like the cut crystal glass and like all that stuff. And everybody's like, oh my God, like it's so beautiful. And I'm like, well, little did you know. That comes out of us, you know, being completely broke. And I took the last $2,000 out of our bank account in London at an ATM on Portobello Road and literally walked down Portobello and haggled with all of the old women there just for like silver spoons and plateware and all these things. And then I bought a suitcase for 25 quid. And packed it all in my suitcase wow. and brought it back. And that's how we opened the
So
restaurant.
You opened with no capital.
Yeah.
That's really stressful, having done that.
It's scary.
Yeah, it's very scary.
It's so scary, you know, because it's like, you know, we spent it all like buying the business and like lawyers and like all this other stuff.
So that's a lot of pressure on you. So you've got
it
all
is.
That financial pressure. You've bought this restaurant from mm-hmm. this famous New Yorker.
Right.
So all eyes
so
are
much,
now on you.
Right. So much pressure. Mm-hmm. And then Pete walks in. Like
oh,
not
how
even
soon?
A month.
No.
He didn't even give me a month. Yeah.
Pete
yeah.
Wells being the restaurant critic of the New York Times.
Yeah. He's there's 2-star reviews and then there's 2-star love letters. And I think we definitely got a 2-star love letter. Mm-hmm. I've had to, make my peace with the culinary gods that I'm never going to get a James Beard Award because I walked out of my own dinner at the James Beard House.
I would never say never.
Oh, I don't know. I walked out of my
You'll
own dinner.
You'll get a James Beard Award. Don't be dramatic.
I walked out of my own dinner at the James Beard House to come cook for Pete. So
that's a good reason.
Yeah. It was really
You'll
good.
Get
I was
one.
Like, I have
Want
to
bet
go.
Right now? Bet you $50.
It's like, I have to go.
You'll get a James Beard Award in the next, like,
oh, we'll see.
3 years.
You know,
years.
But the interesting thing, though, Carrie, is that you know, all the accolades have kind of stopped mattering to me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing. It's like Michelin, James Beard, I actually don't really care anymore. And it's been interesting because that's kind of like a recent revelation in the past like year and a half for me. Where it's like, you know, I opened the restaurant. We got this amazing review from Pete Wells. And then, you know, Jordana and Food & Wine, you know, Best New Chef, which was such an honor. And then after that, I felt like I kind of lost my way. Right? Where I was just like, okay, what's the next accolade? What's the next accolade? We have to achieve all these things. Until I realized that I was so creatively blocked that I couldn't come up with any food that I really loved. And that was really hard for me because I'm all about the creativeness, you know, the creative ethos of this restaurant, mm-hmm. right? And it was then that I realized, I was like, holy shit, I stopped cooking for me and I'm cooking for critics now. I got to stop that. And so then, you know, like when I realized that, I said, you know what? My restaurant is busy. I have a great review from the Times. I'm happy here and my team is happy and we're building something. So why should I cook for anybody else and try to put my standards at Michelin or like whatever? Like, who cares? I don't care anymore. And I just, like, as soon as I took that mindset, I've never been so like relaxed and free and comfortable in my own creativity and in my own home as when I just said, I'm not going to do anything else. Like, I just want to do what we do.
That's so interesting you say that, because you versus a lot of chefs in this country, in the city, just in general, have such a strong culinary signature. Mm. How did that develop?
Well, I don't go out to eat. You know, I stopped going out to eat a while ago because I felt like I was starting to get influenced by everybody else's ideas. And like, I don't follow a lot of people on social media. I don't want to. And it's not because I, you know, don't care. It's just because I actually, there's so much information. And if you actually look at a lot of people's feeds, like everybody's food looks the same. And there's like all these trends in dining and like, you know, whatever. I've never really followed that. And my food doesn't follow that. And I felt like if I was going out to eat and I was following these people on social and like looking at all these other things, that I was going to subconsciously get influenced. So I stopped that. I unfollowed everybody. Stopped going out to eat. I only go eat sushi because it's vastly different from what I do. And pasta. And that's, you know, that's really it. But
I can handle that.
Yeah.
Only going out to eat for sushi and pasta. Yeah.
And I have the best beef in the city anyway. So why would I want to go eat anybody else's beef? So I was like, you know, like, let me just put everybody on mute and like do this and just only focus on what I want my ideas to be and what I want my food to be. And, you know, a lot of my food isn't inspired by the season or like a protein. You know, my creativity and what I really, when I'm like designing a new season's menu, it comes off of artwork or fashion or, you know, something like that. But it's not like, oh, it's spring, we should cook lamb. What goes with lamb? I don't care about that. It doesn't make sense. Really, at the end of the day, it's like whatever protein ends up on the plate or whatever the dish is, it's truly just a vehicle to relay to our diners the inspiration and what the message and what the ethos of the menus and the season is. And that can come from anywhere. This autumn, you know, I became very obsessed with the Dior Haute Couture show, which I thought was beautiful, and it was done entirely in black. And it was just like,
they finally have a female designer.
It was amazing, right? Mm-hmm. And it forced you, you know, that whole line, like I was so in awe by it because it was done completely in black and it was so feminine, but it was strong and it was modern and it was, you know, it was like architectural. And it really forced me to go back and to look at the details in very classic French cuisine and how to make that modern and how to make that feminine. And that's really, I mean, that's what our autumn menu is based on, is that Dior Haute Couture show.
Very cool. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's fun.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Angie. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there. London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. We're back with Angie Marr. So you are an unabashed champion of all things meat, and we are living in a plant-based world.
Mm-hmm. We are. But according to the Times, like a week and a half ago, you know, they said that you, it's okay, you can eat meat now.
It is okay. It's so confusing.
It's so confusing.
Is it all plant-based? Is meat okay? But you don't care.
I don't care.
Yeah.
I think everything should be done in moderation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's not like I'm, you know, sitting here eating.
Moderation is the last word I thought would come out of your mouth.
I know.
You're not so exactly weird, the queen of moderation.
I know, but it's not like I'm sitting here, like, you know, just eating a steak, like, every single, you know, night. That's not what I do. But everything should be in moderation, and I just eat what I love, and I cook what I love, and I just, you know, don't overdose on it.
How do you feel about the whole plant-based meat trend?
I can't. I just can't. I can't. Because
no Impossible Burger for Angie?
No Impossible Burger for me.
You won't come with me to Dunkin' Donuts to try that fake egg sausage sandwich?
No. I won't do it. You let me know how it is, though.
So you wouldn't even experiment with it at home for kicks?
No, I won't.
Okay.
I can't get
meat
behind
is
it
meat,
because
a plant is
I want
a plant.
The real thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I want the real thing, and I don't want vegetables masquerading as meat, because why? I might as well just eat meat. Like, it's fine, you know. So, I mean, according to the Times, it is now.
How heavily do you get into the supplier side of things? I know you work really closely with Pat mm-hmm. LaFreda, mm-hmm. the meat guy of all New York.
Exactly.
But are you talking to farmers, ranchers, growers?
You know, Pat is really amazing in the fact that he handpicks my meat for this restaurant himself. And then I'm up there once a month. So basically they get deliveries, and then he'll pick the best pieces out for this restaurant. And then I go up there after he's done that. And then I go through and I say, okay, I want all of these things. I will leave these five, but I want these, you know. And so everything is really handpicked. But the great thing about Pat is that he has such a great relationship with his farmers, all of his purveyors, that everything can be traced down to from the beginning of the lifetime of each steer, which that I have full faith in. So that's why it's amazing. And you can tell the difference in the quality of our product.
Mm-hmm. So you leave it to Pat?
I leave it to him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we start to talk about the book, because it's so important, I want to give enough time to it. You know, we talked about how you raised money. Do you two have outside investors?
Mm-mm.
It's all your own money. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, my dad always said, look, he grew up during the Depression. And as I mentioned, he was one of 10 kids. And basically the way it worked was my auntie Ruby was in New York. And when their parents died, she came back with her sisters to Seattle to take care of the younger siblings. And because of that, like, what they did was they would start businesses, and then they would employ, you know, family members and so on and so on. So, you know, growing up this whole time, my dad would be like, if you make money, you make it with the family. You start a business, you start it with your family. And it's all for the growth and betterment of the family, always. So for me, that's really important because, you know, my cousin Melissa and I mean, she grew up in Asia, but, like, you know, got dropped off every summer at my house. We shared a room, we had bunk beds. And, you know, so growing up with somebody, and then you now have a business with that person, it's like there's nobody that understands me better than my cousin, you know, because she's seen it all. And, like, the food that we cook, she understands, because a lot of it, we had versions of it growing up. But my brothers do my website. They designed our menus. Like, you know, it really is soup to nuts. This is a family business.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have it any other way.
So one thing that surprises me, and I think I forget how much you've accomplished in such little time, because it does
feels like forever, though.
Well, you know what it
but
is
it this is a short time.
This restaurant feels like it's been here forever by you. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels so fully fleshed out.
Thank you.
In so many ways.
Thank you.
Meat pun, I guess, intended with that. But I'm surprised you don't have more projects already. Is that by choice, or is that because the industry is not bringing you the projects, or not bringing you the funding?
No, it's not really that. It's, you know, we get pitched all the time. For me, there's never really been a right time for the next project, or the partnership hasn't felt right, or it hasn't been the right time here. And one of the things that I think that a lot of people do, like, their big mistake is that they expand too quickly, because it's like, okay, we're hot now, so we can expand. And it's just like, right, but this is my baby. This is my first restaurant. It is my baby. And if the foundations are not laid here properly, and if my team internally is not at the point where I can take them, like, take, you know, my key people out of this restaurant and move them to a new restaurant to open another project while, you know, the more junior people are ready to move up, then what's the point? Because the whole thing is that if I were, you know, I could have opened another place a year after we opened. I could have opened another place after I got my Times Review. You know, but we weren't ready. I wasn't ready. And this team wasn't ready. And if I had opened something with a team that wasn't ready, it would have either been a failure, or even if it was successful, I would have had to hire from the outside, meaning that I would have to start, like, build a whole new culture, versus now where the foundations are in place here and we have a really great culture here. If I take the people that are already ingrained in that culture and move them to another restaurant and we open that, then that culture is already going to be there. The ethos of what we represent will already be there. And that, I think, is important because, you know, when you, like, no matter where, like, whatever restaurants I do going forward, if you walk in and we have that culture and we have that ethos, you're going to be like, oh yeah, this is an Angie Marr restaurant. I get it. Like, it feels right. You know what I mean? And that's what I think is so important, not just opening something to plant a flag somewhere, but opening something in the right way and because it's the right time and because you're doing something that's right for the team that you have in place. Because, you know, there will be a time where it's like, if I don't open something, where's my team going to go?
Right.
Right? But I haven't had the right team in place until really recently to go and be able to do that.
Okay, good answer. Yeah. I just see these guys doing so many projects, mm-hmm. and I'm like, ugh, Angie Marr should be reinventing the 21 Club. Angie Marr should be in charge of the Four Seasons.
I would love to reinvent the 21 Club,
right?
And I would love to do the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
So if you're listening,
21
call
Club,
me.
Get on it. Okay, let's talk about this beautiful book. Yeah. Got it right here. Butcher and Beast. Why that title?
You know, there was never any other name for that book, ever. My literary agent and I, like, kind of kicked around, you know, a couple ideas, and we were just like, why not? Why would we name it anything else? Like, this is what
it's
it is.
It's a great title.
Yeah, and it wasn't going to be like the Beatrice Inn cookbook, you know what I mean? It was going to be something, it had to be something a little bit different. And because there's so many memoir-like essays and all of that in there, it's just like, it's, you know, it reads, it's like a story.
And the word beast, what can we read into that?
Oh, that's probably me. I don't know. That's probably me.
The business is a beast.
The business is a beast. I mean, the restaurant's a beast. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and also, you know, I think if you want to be in this business, like, you have to be in beast mode all the time. That's what it is. It's like, you know, I'll never get over. You get a lot of people in this business, especially I think the younger generation, right? You know, and they're like, haven't really spent a lot of time, like, you know, learning and, you know, putting in their time, and they're just like, okay, I want to go open a restaurant, I want to, you know, be an executive chef somewhere. It's like, okay, but what value do you bring to the table? What experience do you have to bring to the table? Because, you know, do you understand a P&L? Do you understand labor costs? Do you understand food costs? Can you read your lease? Can you negotiate your rent? What are you going to do when the boiler goes on? Like, what, you know what I mean?
That real estate,
the real
experience
estate,
coming in handy there
really helped. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a business.
So who did you write this book for?
For me. Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess I'm very selfish in that I cook for me. I wrote that book very much for me. And that book was very much a battle to get it to where it is now, as you know. It was supposed to be something very different. Like,
I read in the intro. I mean, we have the same publisher.
Yes.
Clarkson Potter. Hi, Clarkson Potter gang, if you're listening. You said that they wanted you to do basically Beatrice Inn food for the home cook.
Yeah.
And you
like
were like,
to dumb down my recipe. Yeah. Why would I? Why would I? I don't dumb it down when people come to eat. Why would I dumb it down, you know, in a book? It's like, everybody wants to do what's easy, right? Everybody wants to do what's easy. But the thing is that, you know, anything worth doing is not easy. That's a reality of it. And the sooner that more of us can wrap our minds around that, it's like, you know, and everybody's like always saying that, like, I've accomplished a lot in a very short amount of time. Which, you know, it feels like forever, but I guess it's not. I guess it is kind of a short amount of time. I've been in New York for like nine years in December. The reality is because I've never done anything the easy way. You know, I think when we do things the easy way, that's like the long road, right? I'd rather do something the hard way and get it done right and get the experience done. But that's a lot of the mentality behind those recipes and why I refuse to dumb them down is because people should learn. I hope people learn, you know, out of that book, even if it's only for the stories.
So it is one of the more individual cookbooks out there. It doesn't, at a time when so many cookbooks look the same, I mean, we have to be honest.
Yes,
half the cookbooks out there look the same. How did you wind up with such an original looking cookbook?
Well, I wish that I could take credit for the Polaroid aspect of it, but I'm not that genius. It's Johnny Miller.
So it's filled with Polaroid photos.
The entire book is shot in Polaroid.
Very glamorous people and Angie Marr food.
Yes, and there's the debauchery that goes on around one of our tables. But, you know, and first of all, I just have to take the time to thank you. So for those of you that have not heard this story yet, Carrie actually introduced me to Johnny Miller. And
your photographer.
Yeah, my photographer for Butcher and Beast. And did you do that intentionally? Did you pull him in intentionally?
No.
It was
so InStyle hired him to shoot the story we did with you and Natasha Lyonne. Uh-huh. And I was shocked to learn you didn't have a photographer yet for your cookbook. And Johnny had just done Athena Calderon's, mm-hmm. which is such a beautiful cookbook.
So beautiful.
And I think he and I had been on maybe two shoots at that point. And I just thought he was so chill and low-key.
The best.
And it really came out of my mouth before I could even think, like a lot of things that come out of my mouth. Jess is nodding, our producer. And as soon as it came out of my mouth, I was like, oh, that was like a really bossy, not my business thing to insert myself into.
It was the greatest thing you could have ever
done. And it worked out for you. But no, as soon as it came out of my mouth, I was like, oh, F, I just like put them both in a really weird position, because what if
no,
Angie has no
so
interest
well.
And he has no interest. And
no, we got along so well.
Okay, good.
And
I was worried I created a very awkward moment.
No, you did. I mean, clearly you did not. You created a very beautiful book, Carrie, so thank you. But no, Johnny's so smart and so creative and so brilliant. And this is a really big departure from his other work. Mm-hmm. You know, after you introduced us, we had a bunch of dates. We had some phone dates and he came in to eat. And then we got to know each other because we were like, okay, if we're going to work together, we have to really get on, right?
He's low key.
He is low key. I'm not low key. Really? Are we really on this? I do think I am in my own way.
Okay. We have 10 more minutes. You can convince me how low key you are.
I know. Well,
I'm sitting across from you. You've got the world's longest eyelet. You've got these insane eyelashes I've never seen before in my life. Like I said, you came dressed like a rock star.
I was seeing
such
you,
a force.
So I had to,
And I wore jeans and a striped sweater. No, I guess it's just the definition of low key. Like, I understand why you think you're low key, but I think to the rest of us, you are such a force.
Oh, well, thank you.
You are glamorous. You are talented. You are just, that's why I'm shocked you don't
thank
have like
you.
10 other restaurants.
No, thank you. That means a lot to me that you say that.
And you know, I love your food.
Yes. I know you'll sneak in here on the low and then tell me when you're leaving.
Well, you know what it is? You don't want to come in and be like, you're busy, you're working.
No, I know, but it's like, it's for me, it's like, because that's what I do is like, I never tell anybody that I'm going to go dine and I like sneak in. And for me, when we first were getting to know each other, I was like, God, Carrie came in again. She didn't even tell me till after she paid the bill. It's so rude. I just want to take care of her. But, honestly, now that I know you and it's like, it's the classiest thing that you can do.
Aww.
Like truly. So thank you. I appreciate it.
No, I have a great time every time I come here.
Good.
I need to come here with more people though, because
yeah,
I do want to try everything on the menu and it's meat.
Exactly.
My favorite thing though that you make is that plum tart.
Oh my God.
I mean, that blows my mind.
You and Ruth.
Does Ruth Reichel love it also?
It. Yeah, she loves
it. Can you describe it for everybody?
It's a savory plum tart, and the crust is made with 100% beef suet. There's no butter in it, which is why I love it. The tart is hot, and then it's got this arugula salad with it, with Parmesan, and that's cold and crisp, and it's not sweet. It's savory, and that's what I love about it.
Yeah, what do you do with the plums to make them?
It's a little bit of cinnamon.
Okay.
Lots of pepper. A little bit of salt,
because they take on this almost vegetal meaty thing.
I think that's
it's almost indescribable.
It's the beef fat, mm-hmm. In the crust, and it's just it's one of my favorite dishes
good.
As well. Thank
so
you.
Good, and I love your signature dessert,
the creme brulee. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good.
It comes in a bone.
Yeah,
it's like Pebble Flintstones dessert. There,
I know, right?
How'd you come up with that idea?
That was just kind of one of those things where it was like, we have to have a dessert that's centered around beef. And, if you make bone marrow flan, it's like creme brulee can't be that far off. So
really my favorite part of the book is your essay about your philosophy. And we are actually excerpting it in the magazine. And thank you for letting us do that, because I honestly think it's epic. It's one of the best things I've ever read about the industry. I think it deserves to be one of those famous essays that gets passed down to young folk and aspiring folk for this industry. You know, when they do all that best food writing, I would love to see it published in that. But I want you to talk about it. But a few of the lines, like, once upon a time, all you had to do was cook good food. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe it would be depressing to a lot of aspiring chefs out there that it's not just about cooking good food.
It's not. I mean, it's not. And, you know, that's the thing, is that, like, in order to really be successful now, because we live in this industry, we live in this culture, not just our industry, but we live in it, just the time, you know, the times that we're in, is it's just like we have to be able to do everything, right? Like, you know, I am 100% antisocial by nature. I am, you know, I'm very, like,
I think a lot of chefs are. Yeah. That's what draws them to the kitchen.
Oh, I'm like totally, I'm like, you know, socially awkward and antisocial and like whatever. And that's, I just want to be in the kitchen all the time. You know, I've learned over, you know, many years that I can't do that. Like I have to, you know, like I'm literally working the room every single night. You know, I'm, you got to shake hands, you got to kiss babies. You've, you know, got to be able to sit here and do podcasts with you and go on TV, and you've got to be able to do all of these things. It's, you have to really embody your brand. And it's really interesting because it's like everything, I've realized that everything that I do, every single thing that I do, it's all to further the brand. You said something about the way I'm dressed. Well, yeah, like I have, like I'm not rolling out of my house in sweats right now because
Do you ever?
I do. So like on a Sunday when I don't leave the Upper West Side. But even then, it's like I have two modes. It's like the vintage Armani or it's the sweatsuit, but then it's all the diamonds with the sweatsuit so I can be like Biggie Smalls, right? That's what it is. But everything that we do, it's all for the brand and it's all for what we build and to further our brand. And it's, and that's why it's like it's not just about the food. It isn't. And so many people think that it's about the food, but it's like, where's your money coming from? You know, where's your money coming from? Like, you know, and I don't, you know, and you know this about me, and I think that you're the same way. It's that, like, also, are you a good person? Like, just don't be a dick, because we don't support those people. And that's the other thing too, is that a lot of kids grow up in this industry and they like think that it's this whole like rock and roll lifestyle, and it is, but it's not. You know, it is in the fact that it's like, you know, last week I didn't sleep from Wednesday until Sunday, and I was on a plane, and I, you know, went to Florida for 13 hours and like all these other things. But like, that doesn't mean that I was out partying. I was working, and there's not a lot of people understand that.
One of the next things from the essay, you also have to hustle hard, but you have to play the game. People often conflate these, but they're not the same.
Yeah. 100%. There's hustle, which is the working 24/7, and what I'm talking about, and that everything that we do is in service of the brand and all of those things. There's also, yeah, you got to play the game aspect of it. And it's like, I've spent the last 9 years since I got here, you know, I have practically no friends that are chefs. And if I, like, I do have friends that are chefs, I probably recently just met them. But I didn't come up in this industry going out and having like a beer, going out and kicking it with like my fellow cooks. And like, that's who I came up in the industry with. I grew up in this industry working my ass off and cultivating relationships with people like you or people like Eric Asimov or whatever, just people that press and also regulars. And that's something that I think is really important, is that you have to play that. You've got to play that game, because it's, I only do business with people that I like, right? I don't do business with certain purveyors because I don't like them. I won't do interviews with certain people in press because I feel that they've wronged me before. Like, so I won't even play with them anymore. And that's fine, but that's a choice that I've made. And it's, I do business with people that I like. And whether it's sitting down to do a podcast with you or doing an interview with somebody else or even having somebody in to dine with us, just a regular, like, were you an a** to my servers last time you came in? Because I'm probably not going to give you a nice table next time or even take your money at all, because I don't need it. And that's the deal, is that it's just like, it's cultivating those relationships. It's so important, right? it's so important. Like, there's a reason why I'm the first delivery off of the Lifrida truck at 5 a.m. because I've spent years cultivating those relationships, and the same thing with like the fish purveyors and all of that. And it's a very different world. It's a very different world than I think a lot of people who are getting into this industry have this romanticized version of it. And the realities are very different. And one of the reasons why I wrote what I wrote in the introduction to that book is because I don't think it's talked about enough. I mean, I think everybody knows that, and I think everybody's scared to say it. And for me, it was like, if we're going to write a book, we're going to say all the things that everybody knows and is just too scared to say, because I've never been scared to say anything, any of those things. So like, we might as well just put it in a book. Like,
well,
why not?
I'm glad you did. Also, speaking of the book, we need to give a shout out to your co-author.
Yes, Jamie Feldmar.
Jamie Feldmar. How'd you two hook up?
You know, she did this amazing profile in Village Voice, and I really loved her, and I wanted her for the book to begin with, and then I think she was busy, and then she had one project fall through, and she was like, it was like last minute. We were behind schedule and all these things, and the stars just aligned, and it worked out really
well. Oh, good. Well, I'm happy you had a dream team for your project.
I definitely did.
All right, Angie Marr, you're a busy lady, so let's do the speed round.
All right, let's do it.
All right, oldest thing in your fridge?
Champagne.
Song that makes you smile?
Return of the Mac.
A favorite kitchen implement?
A combi oven.
A combi oven?
Yeah.
Okay.
Love it.
Okay. In your professional kitchen?
Yeah,
my professional
kitchen. Probably a can opener. I'm not really home that often.
A can opener. Dream vacation destination?
Ooh, Paris is like one of my favorite places on earth.
One of your most treasured cookbooks?
Oh, The Joy of Cooking. And I've got like a first edition from my father.
Wow.
Yeah, love it. It's like torn and tattered and stained, and it's just one of my favorite things.
Food you would never eat?
Cardoons, beets, cooked fish. Unless it's done Chinese style or fried, then I can eat it.
Cardoons, beets, and cooked fish. That is a very specific list.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know. You know, it's really funny. Thomas Keller and Corey Chow are like the only ones that like really know that. So every time I go eat, they'll never give me cooked fish unless it's fried. They just give me raw fish or fried fish. And I always like want to cry every time I'm there because it's so thoughtful.
I thought you were going to say they mess with you and they serve you cooked fish with cardoons and beets. It's like, that's gross.
I know, right?
All right.
That would be funny though.
If you had to be trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be and why?
I feel like it would be Marco Pierre White.
Ah!
I feel like we'd get along.
He just got along. In a little hot water because he said something stupid, shocker, about women being too emotional to work in the kitchen and they can't lift heavy things.
Oh, really?
Things.
Maybe I don't want to be on an island with him.
Or you could be on the island with him and set him straight.
And set him straight and be like, let me just tell you something.
As you save his ass on that desert island. Maybe that wouldn't be the worst pairing.
No, it wouldn't. Like, I would... I'd be hunting. I'd be like, I'll hunt you, cook. There you go.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Angie Marr and her team at the Beatrice Inn. Angie's very first cookbook, Butcher and Beast, is out now, and you need to check it out. Thank you to Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Schools and Emmy Cheese from Switzerland for supporting our show. It means a lot to us. Our show is produced, engineered, and edited by Jess Seidman. Thank you to the Cherry Bomb team, Lauren Goldstein, Audrey Payne, Kia Damone, Maria Sanchez, Donna Yen, and our publisher, Kate Miller Spencer. Our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Tra La La. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hi, my name is Amanda Saab. I am the founder and baker at Butter Bear Shop, a bakery in Livonia, Michigan. I think Davita Davison of Food Lab Detroit is the bomb because she's created a network of like-minded entrepreneurs who set out to have triple bottom line businesses, which means we focus on planet, people, and profitability. Thank you, Davita.